Welcome to Growth Marketing Today, where marketers, designers, and product owners level up their growth marketing chops from experts in today's top startups. Here's your host, Ramley John.
Welcome to episode 146 of Growth Marketing Today. Today, I have Trevor, and we are going to be talking about paid acquisition channel. Once your startup has product market fit, the next stage is to throw more fuel to the fire and accelerate growth. Now, Trevor, founder of CrowdTamers, has taken a dozen startups from zero to over 2 million in ARR, mentored more than 200 startups, and taught thousands. And in this episode, he shares his battle-tested process to test and validate channels to scale customer acquisition. In episode 146, you learn how to first, validate the messaging and audience. Second, build and normalize revenue channels. And third, scale performance. Before we go on, I just want to thank the sponsor for this episode. Now, this folks help cover the cost of hosting and marketing tools so I can focus on getting amazing experts that you and I can learn from. This episode of Growth Marketing Today is brought to you by Partner Stacked. It's G2's number one rated partner management platform. Fully support your partner marketing, referral, and reseller channel programs, all from a single platform. Take the admin work out of your workflows and focus on partner success and scale. If you're ready to scale revenue through partnerships, visit get.partnerstack.com/GMT to book a free demo today or find the link in the description right now. Let's jump into my chat with Trevor. Everybody, welcome to another episode of the Growth Marketing Today podcast. Today, I have Trevor, founder of CrowdTamers, and he's built startups from zero to 2 million 12 times. So we're going to be talking about his playbook. But before we do, Trevor, how's it going, man? How are things with you?
Doing pretty well. I've been surviving COVID, which is the best one can hope for, I think, and even thriving. Growing a business is not something I thought I'd be doing in these times, but there you go.
I was just joking before we started how your voice sounds so good. Like you could read a book. I'm sure people who are listening in is like, how can I hire Trevor to read my startups?
There you go. You're getting sleepy. Very sleepy.
Well, it's very calming and it's, you know, very trustworthy. I think I forgot where I took a few Toastmasters class, for speeches, and they say that great speeches are speech givers. They lower their tone to build with trust, like that lower your voice. Interesting. Really interesting.
And speak more slowly. That's the other big one, because not everybody can go at the speed of a real fast talk. And so when you slow down a bit, it makes you sound more important, even though you're still saying the same dumb stuff.
It's so true. And they studied every speech from precedents, and they found that, I forgot how many words per minute, it was a lot slower than the average person for sure.
That's right.
Really, really interesting. Well, I mean, I was going to ask you about Croatia, but this is way more interesting to talk about, just to warm people up about you. I mean, let's jump right in to talk about you. You have this playbook for successfully launching new products. In your Twitter, you said that, you know, I just mentioned it earlier, that you built startups from zero to 2 million 12 times, which is very impressive, because a lot of people are struggling to just build one. Can you share a little bit about your why? I mean, startups are like, are you addicted to this? This painful experience of start creating product. And for a lot of people, it is a painful experience to like restart from the beginning. So can you share how and why and where and when?
Sure. It's worth noting I've done this 12 times. I have launched probably 50 startups. So the success rate, nowhere near 100%. And I got my start in startup marketing. I was hired as a copywriter for a accelerator in Florida back in 2006, so a long time ago. And was almost immediately promoted to VP of marketing, despite having no knowledge of what I was doing, because the VP of marketing there quit. And at that point, I was then in charge of launching these startups who joined the accelerator, and I had no clue what I was doing. But I at least took good notes. And so over the process of launching four or five really unsuccessfully, I learned a bunch of what not to do. And then started to learn after that what I should be doing, and began to put together this need to figure out how data and the creativity of marketing can combine to help you listen, understand, and figure out what the market is telling you when you launch to market. And I thought I invented something new. I called it scientific marketing for a few years around Florida. If you were in the startup space, I would go to events and talk about this, because the idea was you make a hypothesis, you test, you form a conclusion, there you go. And then I discovered that this is called growth marketing. I didn't invent it. It was there, and made that kind of that approach, that key idea is what I build on and build from and develop on, and have worked out this rather dependable system of a series of steps that takes you from what are we doing, right? We've launched a product and we have no idea how to make money with it, to this is the market, this is the audience, this is the pitch, this is the landing page, this is the funnel. And it works best for SaaS startups because it goes real fast, right? This is 9 distinct experiments. You can do it in 9 weeks. So in 2 months and a little bit, you could say, I've got a funnel that will take me to $1 million or more in revenue. But when you build something that fast, you are not doing it with great fidelity, great finesse, right? You just bash something together in a hurry. And SaaS startups have high margins, so they can afford to have a poorly optimized funnel that works, and then spend 6 months or 9 months making it as optimized as possible and reduce that cost for acquisition 50 or 70% over those 6 months. That's kind of the system I've developed, taken startups from anywhere up to even $16 million a year for one of them with that system, although it took 4 years, and kind of have now made my agency around the idea of I see so many good ideas for startups that fail because they never figure out how to get their idea up off the ground, even to $1 million, right? 92% of businesses never even make $1 million. And I won't say it's easy. It's not easy, but it's simple to figure out the process that gets you there.
I love it. And you're kind of leading it into it already around that playbook, and you call it the growth to market playbook, which I like. It's a play on words with go to market. You also wrote an article about this on CrowdTamer, so I'm going to link that on the show notes for people to check out if they wanted to read through it. But let's go through those 5 focus experiments, particularly one by one. The first one's really focused on key feature differentiation. Can you talk a little bit about each experiment? And I can ask some follow-up questions as you go along.
Sure. So the idea at the very beginning is you have usually no real proof of how you want to go to market. You have an idea, right? You don't launch a product and go, I don't know who's going to buy this. But you don't have data. And what I do to help bring that data in is there's a trade-off you have to make in a startup where you decide, do I wish to spend money or do I wish to spend time? And in the very earliest stages, the founder has no capital frequently. They don't have their own money. If they do, they're already trading money for time. If they don't, they're waiting for an investment. And so they're trading all their time because there's no money. Once you've gotten angel round, seed round, whatever it is, and you've got 100,000 or more in the bank, you can begin to say, I'd rather trade some money and spend less time. And so what this whole experiment cycle is saying, let's spend, you can spend, if you're doing it yourself, as little as $5,000 or $6,000 of money, and you'll learn over those 9 weeks what might take you a year or 18 months to do if it's just trying to do it with time. So the very, very beginning, you don't really know what to do in terms of actual performance for this. So you want to build some ad campaigns that are there just to say, is what I sell interesting to somebody? And now a good marketer will tell you, and I'd like to think I'm at least an okay marketer, you don't sell on features, you sell on benefits. But in the very beginning, you don't even know what your benefits are, because the benefits require knowing who wants it. So we start with a feature and we say, usually each of these experiments comes in pairs, because you start with, I have no idea. And then after your first test to market, you go, oh, this was maybe the right thing. Let me double down and learn more about it. So let's come up with a mock business idea here. Think of something, Ramli, that we're going to launch to market right now today. What do you think it'll be?
Oh, man. You're putting me on the spot. Should I come up with like a product, or does it have to be
a SaaS startup, any business idea that you can think of? Well, you can tell me to come up with one, but then it's...
Yeah, you know. I mean, let's say... a new calendar tool. Like, let's say you were trying to compete. Yeah. So connecting something a podcast guest can use to book time with their guests so that it's more podcasty versus Calendly, which is more general and broad.
Gotcha. All right, cool. So at that point, then you're going to want to be talking to largely marketers or business, small business owners, and booking time for them on discussions. And sometimes you'll have larger businesses, like you recently interviewed the CEO of Circle.so. It's a little bit larger business, right? His time is a little busier. And being able to say, all right, I want to not just have a Calendly link, but something that not just finds the time, but also probably sets them up for success as the interview starts, right? Maybe we're automating some of the tech checks to make sure, does the mic work? Does the camera work? I mean, this is after the year of COVID 2020. All of us know how our webcams work, but even still, then your feature differentiation comes with, I go to the podcast host and I say, wouldn't it be nice if every guest showed up on your call immediately prepared? All the tech works. There's and the feature would be automatically do all the tech checks, automatically send your list of questions ahead of time, and share the link and record it automatically too. There's three features, right? Which of these resonates with the podcast host? We don't know yet. So we take these ads, we run to market, and one of them is automatically validate your tech checks. The other is automatically send your questions and maybe even get responses ahead of time before the podcast. And the third one is record and manage everything around the actual podcast itself in this calendar booking tool as well. These three ads go out Facebook, right? Real broad display buy. We're just going to see people who are probably under 50. I don't think many podcasters are over 50, and largely male, because podcasters are largely male. Buy the ads, run them, and just see who's clicking. And you want to get the demographic information now to say, oh, actually, this does real well for 18 to 26-year-olds and principally over on the West Coast. Now we're able to say the second iteration of our experiments is going to take the knowledge we learned last time and apply it to this time. And so that kind of call and response almost of experiments tends to run throughout these nine steps. So the first one is, what's out there? The second one goes, oh, actually, the best one is automatically processed recordings. That's the one that resonates the most. So then the second experiment becomes, how do I talk about that, right? And is it recordings are automated? Is it never worry about, did that recording save? Is it automatically share recordings with your podcast guests so they can listen to themselves too before you actually do all the edits? Okay, there's three different ways to talk about this exact same feature. Then you test that. And at the end of this, you'll have whatever performed the best. General rule of thumb, any of these ads, if you're not getting at least a 2% click-through rate on them, no one cares. So if you're doing this and you've got, you know, 0.1%, 0.2%, and 0.4%, you're like, oh, that's the winner. No, they're all losers. You have lost. Try again. And then what you want to do is find something that's at least 2%, right? And frequently I'm seeing 7, 8, even 10% on the click-through rate sometimes if it's a really, really well-targeted message to a very interested crowd. But kind of bottom level of interest, right? Then you go from there. All right, now we've found these people. They're over in the Western Coast. It's all you California podcasters, and mostly men, 18 to 24. Okay, but how do I, that's still pretty broad. How do I narrow this down some more? Can I see people who are interested in, I don't know, some audio effects software, or are they interested in maybe all podcasters are also DJs and no one knows this or whatever. Find some parallel looking audiences and you test to them and you say, for these different personas of podcast owner, then do I also want to try to message to the, maybe the VA who's doing the work or the assistant who's doing the work on the podcast? Maybe I can do a bottom-up sale and not have the person who's running it who's like, I don't care what the tools are. I just show up and talk and I'm beautiful. And then there's the person who's stuck doing the grunt labor who goes, well, I would like to have this be a better tool. So you try some persona differentiation there till you find what works best and then do a second pass on it. So experiment round three is the first persona test. Round four is the refinement of it, where we're saying, okay, it is the podcast owner because most podcasts don't have dedicated VAs. They're not doing right. That phenomenally well. I mean, I don't know about you. Are you in that deep podcast money, Ramley?
I mean, I got somebody else editing my podcast, so I'm not...
you're rolling deep.
No. let's say I'm just breaking even. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm good enough to hire a podcast editor so I don't have to edit my shows anymore.
Gotcha. Well, to be fair, in podcast parlance, breaking even is rolling deep. So from there, then we start to see what channels, right? And there's a philosophical difference in display marketing versus search marketing. And so one of the things you test here is display marketing is passive. I went to Facebook because I wanted to see, I don't know, the latest news about my aunt's cats or whatever horrible reason I've gone to Facebook. And or Instagram, I go there to feel bad about myself because everybody else is prettier than me. Whatever it is I'm doing, it's a passive consumption. An ad shows up and I go, okay, I'll click on that. Let me learn more. A Google ad is intent. I'm looking for a solution to a problem. Almost overwhelmingly, Google ads outperform on the bottom of the funnel for display ads. This should be news to no one listening to the podcast, but just in case it is, hi, welcome to Growth Today. We talk about marketing. The test you're doing here, though, is to see top of funnel, what are my costs going to be? So you can try Facebook and Twitter and even sometimes LinkedIn. Straight display, you just want to get a feeling for how those channels do. Versus the next test is saying, if I look at Google search instead, right, it's going to cost more per click, but am I getting better signups? Because our focus right now is all top of the funnel, but we're sending traffic somewhere. We should be. Ideally, not the homepage. We should be. Again, if this is news, welcome to Growth Marketing Today. This is a podcast where Ronnie talks about stuff. You should know this by now. The step after that is to say, okay, I've seen what my benchmarks are on these channels, and I'm continuing to tweak creative and messaging as well. So I'm talking about, I've been doing feature messaging in the beginning because I don't know what my benefits are. Mm-hmm. Once I know, California podcasts who are familiar with tech, who are early adopters of programs and who all weirdly have an affinity for wakeboarding, I'm able to say, okay, my messaging now is speaking to their benefits where I can say, hey, Ramly, get more time for wakeboarding by having our software automate all the garbage you don't want to do. So now there's a benefit, right? Oh, I can go hit the beach, which Toronto, of course, where you are, is famous for its coastline. And whatever that benefit you can offer is what you're messaging on now. So you're continuing to test the message while you're working on your platforms. And at the end of your three positioning tests on channel, you're also trying those benefits around what exact language resonates best. And then the final tests you do, the last two, are saying, okay, I've got a top of funnel that is quite dependable now. I have found a click cost that I'm comfortable enough with. It's relatively stable. I have the right message. I have the right visuals. I have the right benefits. Now I should look at the bottom of my funnel and do something with it, because all this time it's been a trash fire I've been ignoring because I've just been focused on demand gen. Now your demand gen system is relatively set. You say, what do I do at the bottom to do something with all this traffic? At that point, you start with landing page optimization, right? Copy, benefits. You go through the classic landing page optimization stuff that just people do. But you know you got a very targeted and defined persona coming here. So it's really easy to make this landing page speak directly to them. And then you do a couple iterations, two on that. And at the end of this, now you've got a funnel from top to bottom that should work reliably. Then the next thing is to say, over the months after this, I'm going to optimize it. But right now, if I've got, hey, I'm spending $60 to acquire a sign up for our new podcast software, and I'm charging them $5 a month. CAC to LTV is not too bad. I can go to an investor and say, give me $100,000 and I'll turn it into $300,000 over the course of a year. That's a compelling offer. I can get my seed round and go. And so CrowdTamers builds this process for companies, gets them to seed round, A round, wherever, and then off they go on their merry way. Well, I've kind of helped these companies figure out all the processes, but I don't have to build this, right? I publish these steps and I talk about it a lot. Any company can go do the same thing and reach these same results with variances over how good a copywriter and designer you may be able to do on your actual execution.
Really, really fascinating. I love how you broke this down. I mean, I'm sure I have kind of follow-up questions around this. I mean, first of all, I love how you broke it down step by step. It feels like, you know, instead of like, it's like if you don't know where your direction is, you take one step and then you look around, you take another step, then you look around. This is essentially it, and you're building it one by one, starting off with your differentiator, like what is it people actually want. You go on to the key features, to target persona, and then zoning in the target persona, the visuals, then you go into competitive analysis, then you break it out to like now different channels, which channels is working best. So I really, really appreciate that. And then in terms of the experiment itself, can you talk a little bit about how you talked about click through rate? Is that your measure of success? How do you know one over the other? Is it click through rate, or are you looking at more? You have a landing page and you actually see if people provide the email and which one gives you more emails. Like what's your thoughts around how you structure those experiments?
So it is initially, I'm looking at just top of funnel driving interest. Later on, around the fifth or sixth experiment, I'm trying to get to an actual conversion through. Most early stage startups, their reporting is they added the Google Analytics tag on their page and then said, job's done, Bob's your uncle. And their ability to extract greater data out, and frequently in their actual app, they have nothing because developers go, I don't want Google calling JavaScript and slowing down my page load times. Okay, then you're missing obviously all of the data about onboarding, but also the handoff between website and product missing. So you'd be able to say these clicks, what did they do, is usually very, very hard at early stage startup. So deliberately, I'm focusing here on the earliest signal I can find. And for the first four experiments, because it's click-through rate driven, that's all in Facebook, right? You don't even have to have analytics on your website. You should, but you don't. That way you can build up the other parts of it later. I launched for a client a month ago a first test, so experiment round one, ER1 in my kind of naming terminology here. They didn't have a website. They didn't even have a brand name. And I just did straight three different ads that drove to a Facebook lead conversion form. That was it. And that let them see when they launched, in a couple of weeks, which of these three offers was the best one to get people to sign up for the product on the actual launch. And that was a lesson they could get. And also they got a bunch of demographic data on these people who were signing up to help them do more targeting just preposterously early, right? Who launches an ad campaign before you even have a name? This is nonsense. But it can work if you are of that growth mindset where you say, I don't care what the name is. I just want to see, like, what do I have to do to get this up off the ground? So at that point, analytics doesn't matter so much. Later on in this discussion, I would want to see email signups, or if it's an actual product, even conversion to buy or conversion to subscribe. But the obsession up until the eighth experiment really is, can I bring the right person? And then I start to say, once I've brought the right person, can I do anything with them?
Interesting. So interesting that you're testing this out. And this goes back to, hey, is this something people want before you build it? So you're actually kind of testing out the market and the demand and which features to build before you even launch the product, and you are like kind of have some kind of data around that. I want to get more into details around, you talked about Facebook lead form. What was your offer? Like, do you say, hey, we're building this product, you'll be the first to know, fill out this form? Or usually I see it more as, hey, get a guide around this problem. Like, how are you messaging that first initial experiments for them to click on it first or fill out a lead form, since there's no product in the beginning?
I have a long history of, I've been teaching startups how to go to market or grow to market for a decade or more. And I want the first class I teach at accelerators like Founder Institute or Startup Hub, which is a Google campus in Warsaw, or other ones I've been at, is you need to launch something this weekend. Right. And they go, I don't have anything written yet. And I go, shut up. You're launching something this weekend. Go to Squarespace. Just build a form. don't need any product yet. Act as if you have the product and see if you can get the sign up. And so like for this client that had no product, no name, nothing yet, they were a media company and saying, okay, sign up. They had three different tests. One was sign up for just our media company newsletter, which no one cared about because why would you? Another one was get this free ebook, which not many people cared about because why would you? And then the third one was get a freestanding desk, which you go, oh, those are expensive. Now, what they were giving away was a $20 cardboard standing desk, but like they weren't lying. They showed the picture, they like everything about it. It's a standing desk, get it for free. And they had a random draw. I think you get one of five. And at that point, just seeing on the website, once traffic comes, what would be the best newsletter sign up for this media company? And the answer was the standing desk did way, way, way better, to the point where I had to turn off that part of the ad because we wanted to see what was the best second offer. And it was so overwhelmingly to the standing desk. They had like, I think it was 30 cents per lead, just dirt cheap for the standing desk. And then a couple bucks per lead for the other two because no one cared about them. So like this approach let them validate, okay, we got to do the standing desk thing and we do a draw. Right. And now they knew what to do for their actual launch.
I really like this idea. I mean, because for people listening in, my wife launched this product, a Montessori product for moms. And I'm like, I should be doing this for that.
There you go.
I should be like figuring this stuff out. And really interesting. I mean, so you're doing all this testing around feature and demand for the product. Once you've kind of figured out, you talked about persona and geography. I know, for example, you said, what if it's podcasts from California? But how do you figure that out for, like, how do you figure out how to segment the, which personas to test out? I'm guessing it depends on the product as well. Let's go back to that standing desk one. How did you figure out who's going to use it, that particular standing desk, and testing out which personas?
So in Facebook particularly, but also in Twitter and to a much lesser extent, Google, you get demographic data on who's clicking on your ads. And taking that information, one, you can do it by hand, like, Bob Cratchit in the 1800s and in Christmas Carol. What I tend to do is I have a variety of different AI tools I plug into client ad accounts. One that I've been using recently is called Morpheo. And it basically identifies for you. It says like, hey, this ad underperformed with 55-year-olds in Texas. Stop running it there. I'm like, okay. Done. Like click the button. They did all the hard work for me. I didn't have to go look. And it also helps me say like, it does real well with 67-year-old women who like macrame in Michigan. Okay, done. I'll advertise more to them. All 70 of them, whatever. The AI is basically spotting these tiny niches for me. Before that, I would just look at the data myself and analyze and do hard thinking. But I prefer when I can make computers think more than me.
When we come back in just a minute, Trevor is going to share exactly how he scales the performance of his ad campaigns. Before we go on, I want to thank the sponsor for this episode. The PartnerStack G2's top-rated partner management platform is the only partnership platform built for SaaS, designed to deliver predictable revenue and accelerate growth for businesses and their partners. Companies like Intercom, Webflow, and Monday.com use PartnerStack to manage and scale their programs, automating partner onboarding, training, payments, and more to empower their partners' success. The past year alone, partners in the PartnerStack network have generated over $100 million in revenue for programs on PartnerStack. Fully support your partner marketing referral and reseller channel programs from a single platform. Now take the admin work out of your workflows and focus on partner success and scale by automating partner onboarding, attribution, engagement, payouts, and compliance. Now tap into the only global B2B partner network supporting over 500,000 partnerships and counting. If you're ready to scale your revenue to partnerships, visit get.partnerstack.com/GMT to book a demo today or find the link in the description. Well, let's get back to my chat with Trevor. I didn't even think about that. I didn't even think about that tool. I mean, I guess that's a good lead up to what kind of tools are you using? Like you got that, what did you call it? Morpheo.
I think more for you. I'm going to real quick open up a tab while we're talking to make sure I'm not, you know, pimping the wrong product. Morpho. I mean, I can't type. Oh, yeah, morpho.ai. Morpho.ai.
And then can you talk a little bit about more other tools that you're currently using to make this whole process easier? Because I was thinking, well, I'm just going to use Facebook data and then go from there. But it's obvious you have ninja tools that people are not familiar with.
Ninja tools. I am a salty old dog of a marketer. I've been doing marketing for 20 something years. And I do tend to do a lot of working on primary sources. Like I do just buy ads through Facebook's interface. I don't use a manager for it. And my actual tool stack is fairly light, in part because every client has their own tool stack, right? And I don't want to have to onboard to HubSpot or Pardot or I don't know what other platform they may be using, right? I just go into Facebook ads and manage everything there. On the reporting side, on the data side, I do use tools like Google Data Studio. I use Morpho.ai. On the content creation side, I use Copysmith and Copy.ai and Conversion.ai. I actually have all three of them, which is it's an AI-based copywriting tool. And it sounds like, why would you buy three? And the answer is each one is a little better at particular things. And so given that the cost is like $30 or $100 a month, compared to having a copywriter, it is still nothing. And I'll use the right tool for the job based on what I need to do. And kind of all this combination of using AI to help discover data and help generate new content for clients is part of a philosophy of crowd tamers, I would say, in that we're looking at a big shift in the MarTech space in the next 18 months. A whole swath of entry-level marketing work, whether it's simple data management, simple copywriting, simple graphic design, is just going to go away. And right now I'm making use of it to make Crowd Tamers kind of bleeding edge marketing company, right, making use of this AI to deliver more solutions to more clients faster. But anybody out there, like if you're a founder right now or you're a growth marketer right now and you're like, but I'm not a good copywriter. Okay, go to copy.ai or conversion.ai, pay $30 or $100 a month and they will be... They're not as good a copywriter as I am. I've been writing copy professionally for 29 years because I made my first sale when I was 10. But most folks are like, I don't know what to write. Copy's hard to come up with. Okay, right. Pay the AI. It does it for you. Mm-hmm. If you're saying data analysis is hard, I don't love to crunch all these numbers, go to Morpho. Have them do it for you, right? A lot of this basic level work can be done for you, and you can focus more on the strategy and the decision making on what to do next instead.
I love that. Thank you for sharing all those things and your opinion around that. I mean, one of the things that I can hear people pushing back on this is, Trevor, my audience is not on Facebook and Instagram. Why would I do this? Like, and well, I'm sure I'm curious what your response is to them, and it's yes, they probably are. There's like multiple billions of people on Facebook, but what would you tell folks who are like, my audience, like I'm targeting CEOs, Trevor, I'm targeting VPs. They're too busy with their life. Like they would never be on Facebook or Instagram.
So there is some truth to that. The answer one is you can go to LinkedIn, although LinkedIn is mostly full of marketers and salespeople and recruiters and not so much your CEO type, but part of what you get with Facebook on Facebook's display network is all those CEOs do go places, like they're on the internet. You can advertise to them there. And honestly, overwhelmingly, you don't sell to CEOs. You sell to the VP or the director, and then the CEO signs off, right? So even if you're making a $400,000 software sale at Oracle or Salesforce, the CEO didn't go searching for better CRM. Somebody else did. And having in your personas, like the CEO maybe gives final buy-off, but who's my journey start with? That's part of the important part of what you're trying to discover. And the data would tell you, right? On LinkedIn, the cost per click is always higher, although you can get $1 or $2 per click if you're building an ad campaign with some smartness. And you can then find out, right, if I go to LinkedIn and target these CEOs and try to bring them into my conversion funnel, how do they look versus bringing that director level through Facebook instead? The answer overwhelmingly tends to be the best thing you get with the CEO is they pass a link off to someone lower in the org chart who then has to start the journey from scratch anyway.
Right.
So I would challenge someone who said, my audience isn't on Facebook, because they probably are, but even if they're not, these same principles apply on Twitter and on LinkedIn and on Pinterest and on anywhere else you think you need to go.
So, I mean, the first few experiments doesn't have to be on Facebook. It can be on LinkedIn. It could be on Twitter, and it could be wherever your audience is from the get-go. Is that what you're suggesting? And it really depends on the product too, as well, maybe.
Yeah, I default to Facebook despite maybe personal ethical reservations about Facebook just as an entity, but because everybody you want is there. The other two ways I have gone about top of funnel qualification, one is LinkedIn, the other actually is cold outreach email. Because cold outreach email looks a lot like display, except all you're displaying is 86 characters of text. And the exact same principles can apply if you look at it that way. If I'm putting this in people's inboxes, they're scanning. If I grab their eye for 1 second, they may open the email. Then I've got 7 seconds to convince them to do something besides look at it and go and delete it. And then I've got 30 seconds to convince them to take an action. It's the exact same mindset as a display ad. So if you are like, you cannot do traditional display ads because I only sell to chief security officers at Fortune 2000 companies. Okay, yeah, they probably have ad blocker turned on. And then you say, how do I get in front of them some other way? And I have had success with finding those people on email outreach instead. It is, in some ways, it doesn't sound like it, but it's the same tool, the same process.
And it would make sense to start off with Facebook. Like I said, most likely people are on Facebook or Instagram. Like that's and you're right about the ethical dilemma of what the heck are they doing? They're on a battle right now with Apple, trying to figure out all this privacy stuff. But guys, like, I mean, the topic that we're talking about is testing and going back to it, test the product, the value proposition, the key feature differentiation from the get-go. You brought up a few examples already you apply this process to with that standing table. Can you think of another, like, I'm sure you have a ton more examples. Can you think of another one where like you applied the same process and I'm curious what the results were?
Sure. So one of my clients produces a hardware device that was initially designed to help the profoundly hard of hearing be more aware of the world around them. It looked like a wristwatch, but it has 4 haptic motors on it spaced around the band so that at low frequencies, like, you know, a low pitch rumble like a truck, one motor would vibrate, and a high pitch like a microwave, a different motor would vibrate. And so you could, on your wrist, get a feeling for the sound environment around you. The product was about $250 and was marketed to deaf and profoundly hard of hearing. And the deaf and profoundly hard of hearing tend to be underemployed because they tend to either work in trades like printing or construction or really loud industry where they won't lose their hearing because it's already gone, or they are underemployed just because their language communication in English can be very challenging with them. And so they end up not being able to get much work. So to tell somebody who's working maybe minimum wage, maybe a bit better than minimum wage, hey, give me one of your paychecks this month or half a paycheck this month for a wristwatch device to help you hear is a hard sell. And what they had discovered, right, as they started to work with me, is there might be another market they can go to where people have a better financial capacity to pay. And so they've moved now to where they offer a tinnitus therapy, which combines software and hardware. And this same hardware can help reduce how bad tinnitus is, which is this chronic ringing in your ears. And they had never sold a tinnitus product, right? They sold this hardware product for the hearing impaired. So what I helped them figure out is, what is the market potential? What is the reach? How big an audience can you address? Can they afford to spend this kind of money? And then once we answered all those questions, what's the right branding, messaging, visuals, landing pages, all this, to where they're doing I mean, I have an NDA. I can't go into details, but doing way better as a business because this audience they're going after now are people who, if you have tinnitus, it tends to be you lost your hearing. You worked in a loud trade like the military or in construction, or maybe you just love to go to rock concerts, right? And this means you had to have money at some point so you can afford to spend money to relieve this pain that haunts you day and night. And so that new market, same hardware, adding in software and some other things, really improved their ability to go to market and build and grow their business. So like that is a complete new positioning of a very similar product. The hardware is the same, to totally change the company outcome, right? And that's kind of, that approach shows you can launch to market and even build a product and a team and a startup and not have found the right market to go after.
Interesting. Really, really fascinating. Thank you for sharing that story. I really love how rearing once again that you can test it out even before you have a product or a market that you found. I mean, I want to keep going at this. And one of the things that you also wanted to, that you suggested we talk about is going to the topic for the podcast, growth marketing. You wanted to share three growth marketing tricks that works for almost any SaaS business. And a lot of my listeners are from SaaS business, and I work with a ton of SaaS businesses with product led. So like, I'm curious to hear what those three growth marketing tricks, knowing that you, like you said, like I said earlier, you have done it 12 times, built startups from zero to 2 million. One thing I didn't mention is you also mentor hundreds of startups. So you have seen the pitfalls and the successes. Yeah. So I would love to hear I'm sure my audience would love to hear exactly what those tricks and tips that you have about on growth marketing.
Sure. One tip that is obvious but overlooked is almost every marketer or growth marketer or salesperson or whomever in an organization goes, we could really close more deals, except our product doesn't do X or Y or Z. And it can be real hard in an organization of any size to build a landing page for your product that says you have feature X and you don't have it, right? That's a hard sell. But to come up with a new domain and a new landing page for a product that's very similar to yours with feature X, there's no risk to your core brand, right? You buy the domain through GoDaddy or whatever as anonymized, so no one knows where it's coming from. You can build a landing page using many of the same assets your company has, at least in terms of copy. You probably want new graphics and a logo. Get a logo off of Fiverr, wherever, right? You don't care. And you can find out in a week, does this feature make a real difference? And then if it does, you can go back to the product team and say, hey, so our landing page converts at 6%. We added in feature X, which everyone in the sales team said we need, and it converts at 9%. If we had feature X on the roadmap and we could talk about it in our marketing materials, we'd make $250,000 more dollars next month. That's real persuasive. And by doing this kind of aside and not as core part of the company and everything, you're not necessarily having to get hundreds of stakeholders input and approval and all these things. It lets you ship and learn real fast. And I have at a number of other companies come up with products that don't exist or new ways to use the existing product, whatever, and launch them on the side with new names just to see, right, can this work? The answer overwhelmingly is no, it doesn't matter because features are not what sells. But sometimes the right feature and the right messaging to the right audience really does make a difference. And then you can fold that back into your product and help steer the course of the company. There's one, right? You don't have to actually market your brand if you're a growth marketer. You can just market what you wish your brand did. Another tip that applies for almost any SaaS company is tend to forget the fact that you're bringing all this traffic to your site. And you probably have a funnel where you want folks to buy and a funnel where you're doing remarketing and trying to bring them back and kind of finding many ways on demand gen to bring folks in. And a lot of brands, SaaS companies, don't build around the idea of most of the time, if I've identified a good market and they don't sign up now, that's not a no, I don't want your product. It's I don't want your product right now. One of the best ways you can build long-term value is to find ways to acquire leads that you don't intend to sell to. Right? Build CTAs that are about messaging and branding and community and all these things where you're just as a secondary or tertiary objective, sign up for my blog or whatever it is. A lot of companies, even if they have those, right, it's just kind of, oh, we email these people once a quarter when we remember to do it. Mm-hmm. And email for 35 years on the internet has always been the highest ROI channel. There is never anything that beats email. And so many growth marketers don't think about it because it's not demand gen. So build a habit in your team of getting that tertiary ask and building up a list of people. And then for a month or two, you can just acquire people. But once you've got even a dozen, two dozen, you need to start to think about what you do with this list. And so don't just build a list and be like, hey, it's 7,000 people who we emailed once. Ta-da! I have a practice in place. But if you're writing content, if you're doing SEO, like all this stuff, you can feed back into there. Just keep yourself top of mind. And the third important hack is one that isn't even it's not a growth marketing hack. It's a growth process hack. And the idea is almost every company out there has 15, 20, 30 ideas for what we should do next floating around. And usually every person in the company has 2 or 3 or 5 or 10 ideas for what we should do next that may even, they've told no one.
Yeah, I forget.
Having a central document, right. I use peer scoring. I've written about it on CrowdTamers. More commonly, people know ICE scoring. ICE is importance and, I don't remember what ICE is. Yeah, confidence and effort. And peer is priority, importance, effort, and result. I think sometimes you have priority is different than importance because the boss really wants this now, even though you're like, I don't think it's important. The boss does. So there you go. We're going to do it. So, but either way, it's scoring a number. And even if you're a growth team of one or a marketing team of one, right, build the backlog and then make it public in your company. Of the 10 best campaigns I've ever run for any company, 6 or 7 of them were not brought by somebody in the marketing team. Somebody else went, what if we did this? And I went, that's genius. Yes, we need to. And by opening it up and communicating with people and nurturing them and driving them to contribute to your ICE or your peer or your whatever scoring spreadsheet, where it's a backlog of what you wish you could tackle in order of what you think is most important first, that one gets the whole company thinking about growth. And if you're doing it right, you'll have different teams in the company all demanding that the growth person contribute to their area because they like the accountants will go, what if we did this for our accounting? Would it make it easier for us to sell? And the product team would go, what if we had this feature? And like this becomes core in the company when you encourage this collaboration on this doc. And then as you call out and say, hey, you know, Tom over there from the hardware team had a phenomenal idea for how to talk about this new product and it made a 6% improvement in conversion rate. Good job, Tom. Like whatever. Exposing that idea in the company is a real force multiplier because you don't have to think of all the good ideas. Everybody else is too.
Really fascinating, man. That's so much gold mine there. I hope people would like listen to that and just pause it and just like, hey, I'm gonna write it. I'm gonna put this all in a cheat sheet to make sure that people get all of that stuff in it. I mean, I think that's a good place to wrap up. Just one final question. Where can people find out more about you and your work? And I'm sure you have a ton more tips and advice. I know that you just shared that 9 experiments on your blog, but like where can people find out more about all the stuff that you're doing?
So I am very visible on Twitter at Trevor Longinot. There's only one of me on the internet. If you Google my name, you will always find me.
I like it.
You can also go to my blog at crowdtamers.com. And beyond that, I mean, LinkedIn or any other place you want to stalk me and be creepy, sure, go ahead.
Sweet. Well, thank you so much. I'm going to link all of that on the show notes as well as the podcast episode page to make sure that people can find out if they wanted to reach out and ask you a few questions. Thank you, Trevor. Absolutely. I really do appreciate it.
Thanks, Ramley. It's been fun.
Well, that's it for this episode. Thank you for tuning in all the way into the end. I know I learned a lot from Trevor on how he tests out and build acquisition channels and really how to scale the performance of that. Before we end, I just want to thank again the sponsor for this episode. Now, these folks help cover the cost of hosting and marketing tools so I can focus on getting amazing experts that you and I can learn from. This episode of Growth Marketing Today is brought to you by Partner Stacking. It's G2's number one rated partner management platform. Fully support your partner marketing, referral, and reseller channel programs all from a single platform. Take the admin work out of your workflows and focus on partner success and scale. If you're ready to scale revenue through partnerships, visit get.partnerstack.com/GMT to book a free demo today or find the link in the description right now. Please also support me. There's three easy ways. First, you can tell a friend about this. Word of mouth is really one of the best ways to podcast grow. Second, you can leave a review on Apple Podcasts, whether you're on Apple or right now on Android. Leaving a review does make a big impact. Over 70% of my listeners are on Apple, and it does get more people to listen in on this podcast show. And third, you can join the Grow Today mailing list, where you find out a little bit more about the show and I share a little bit about myself and what's happening in my life. Well, that's it for this episode. Until the next one, keep safe. And as always, keep on growing.